to her. In fact, I was fairly certain I was in love with her, and I didn't even know her cell phone number. How rare was that in the 21st century?
"You're on a secure phone, I assume," she said.
"As secure as it gets in this day and age. This is the only time I'm going to use it. As soon as I hang up, I'm destroying it." She gave me the number, and I wrote it down on a pad Granny had given me. "So, I have your number," I said. "Does this mean we're official? How does it work now? Are we talking? Dating? In a relationship?"
"I can't believe you're being so flippant. My chest is about to explode."
"Drive to Gatlinburg and make sure you aren't followed. When can you be there?"
"I have a couple of things to do here. Give me 2 hours.
11 o'clock then?"
"Will I be breaking a bunch of federal laws by meeting you?" "Shit, never mind. I don't even care. 11 o'clock will work."
"What will you be driving?"
"A blue Ford Fusion Hybrid."
"Figures. I'm going to call you again at 11. Be in the parking lot at the Space Needle."
"I'll be there."
Grace's cell phone rang at precisely 11 o'clock. She looked down at the caller ID and it was blocked. It had to be him. Her heart started racing again and her finger trembled as she pushed the button to answer. What could he possibly have discovered? And why did the prospect of seeing Darren make her tremble?
"Hello?"
"Don't freak out." It was Darren's voice. "In about 30 seconds, an old black Jeep is going to pull up right next to your door. Driving that Jeep is going to be a very scary-looking guy named Eugene. As soon as he pulls up, just get out of your car and get in the Jeep."
"Are you with him?"
"No, but I'm not far away. One of Eugene's brothers and I are in another vehicle. We're going to..."
"Oh my God, he's here!"
"Get in the Jeep. Don't be afraid."
"Don't be afraid? I'm about to pee on myself, Darren."
"Are you getting in the Jeep?"
"Yes."
Grace climbed into the Jeep and found herself staring into the gleaming blue eyes of one of the fiercest-looking men she'd ever seen. He nodded at her, gunned the accelerator, and they pulled out of the parking lot.
"We're on the road,"
Grace said. "You're about to go into the mountains. It's about a half-hour drive to where you're going. I'm behind you. Like I started to say a second ago, we're going to make sure nobody is following you."
"Okay."
"I'll see you soon, Grace. I can't believe I'm really saying that, but I'll see you soon." The idea of seeing Darren outside a jail cell or courtroom was almost unnerving. She'd come to admire his strength and courage during the time they'd known each other, and she'd developed a strong affection for him. But she hadn't really given a real relationship any thought because of Darren's situation. He'd been in prison every day since she'd known him, and she hadn't allowed herself to believe he'd ever get out. Now he was a fugitive, a wanted man on the run. Grace wondered again what Tipton would have to offer. It would have to be something explosive, something that would practically knock the socks off of a federal judge. Otherwise, Darren would be headed straight back to prison if they didn't kill him first. The man named Eugene was silent as they wound through forest and mountain laurels, beside creeks and up steep inclines. The road was full of switchbacks. After 20 minutes of steady climbing, the asphalt ended and the road became gravel. Eventually, the road ended and they pulled onto what appeared to be a driveway of clay and chat.
"Are we close?"
Grace said uncertainly, wondering whether the driver would answer.
"This is our land," Eugene said. 200 acres. Been in our family for 100 years. My granny owns the biggest share of it now. Me and my two brothers own equal shares of the rest."
"What about your parents?"
"Gone. Both of them."
"I'm sorry,"
Grace said as the Jeep bumped along.
"Are you farmers?"
Grace saw Eugene's head turn toward her out of the corner of her eye, and she looked at him. He turned his face back toward the road again and smiled.
"Among other things," he said.
At the end of the driveway was a clearing, and in the clearing were 3 homes arranged in a triangle. 2 of them were large log cabins, and the other was a white frame house. There was a large barn behind the house, a split rail fence, and a couple of outbuildings, one of which Grace recognized as a smokehouse. Grace had expected redneck poverty, but this place was actually quite beautiful. As Eugene parked the Jeep and shut off the engine, she looked up to see a white-haired woman standing on the front porch of the house.
"Is that your grandmother?"
she said.
"That's her. Come on."
"Where's Darren?"
"He'll be along directly."
Grace and Eugene walked onto the porch. The woman nodded and said,
I'm Luann Tipton. Welcome to my home.
Grace Alexander, thank you. I assume you're related to James Tipton?
He's my grandson.
Is he here?
He's inside. You'll meet him in a minute.
Grace had never felt quite like she did in that moment. There was incredible anticipation, both in seeing Darren and in finding out what Tipton had to say. Was he ready to recant? Would he be able to provide some kind of corroboration if he was? Grace heard an engine and looked down the driveway. A red pickup was coming. It pulled up next to the Jeep and Darren climbed out of the passenger side. Before she realized what she was doing, Grace was down the steps and running across the front yard. She jumped into Darren's arms, buried her face in his neck, and felt his arms wrap around her.
I can't believe you're here, she said. I was afraid I might never see you again.
His arms tightened even more, and he lifted her from the ground. You're the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, Darren said. They held each other for a full minute before Darren set her back on the ground and loosened his grip. She stepped back and looked at him.
You're blonde, she said.
Yeah. Like it?
Not really.
She looked at his swollen nose and jaw.
What happened to your face? What is it with you? Every time I see you, you look like somebody's beaten the crap out of you.
Doesn't matter, he said. Come on, let's go inside. James is in there, and he has a hell of a story to tell you. Chapter 57. Grace had been through mock trials in law school, plea negotiations in the real world, and jury trials in federal court, but she'd never been through anything like this. She'd called and insisted on a meeting with United States Attorney Stephen Blackburn, and, after a half hour of wrangling, had finally been granted an audience. But she hadn't expected Ben Clancy to be there. It was the morning after she'd gone to the Tipton farm and talked with James and Darren. What she'd seen and heard had made her stomach turn. To think that a man of Ben Clancy's power and position would use it for such evil purposes shook her faith in the justice system, a system she had believed in fervently when she first came out of law school. She had a copy of the file Gary DuBose had given her sitting on her lap, along with a copy of a flash drive James Tipton had provided. James had told Grace that after he'd killed Jalen Jordan, he knew he was doomed. Yet even in his drug-addled state, he had tried desperately to figure out some way to get some leverage over Clancy on the slim chance he would ever be able to actually use it. Clancy had contacted him immediately after Darren Street was arrested, and the coaching had begun. Clancy always patted him down carefully and inspected him closely, but James had noticed early that Clancy never looked at his shoes. He'd gone online and found a $300 pair of shoes that looked for all the world like an ordinary pair of running shoes. He wore them every time he met Clancy. In the tongue of one of the shoes was a digital camera with audio capability, and in the tongue of the other was a tiny transmitter that sent a signal through a Bluetooth connection to a receiver in James's laptop in the trunk of his Dodge Charger, which was always nearby since Clancy always wanted to meet in some hastily arranged fashion. The quality of the video was poor because the angles were always odd and the audio wasn't great, but the shoes had served their purpose. Each time he met Clancy, immediately following the visit, James would check to make sure he'd captured the meeting. Then he would burn copies onto flash drives and compact discs and take them to his bank, where he had a safety deposit box. He'd also buried copies of the drives and discs in the barrels where his cash was hidden. Grace had given backup copies to her boss in the federal defender's office, an intelligent but timid 50-year-old bureaucrat named Roy Seaton. Seaton had listened to what she had to say, briefly glanced at the paper evidence she'd gathered, shaken his head when she asked whether he wanted to watch the video, and politely declined her invitation to accompany her to the U.S. Attorney's office.
Let me know how it turns out, Seaton had said.
Now Grace sat alone in a room with two men 30 years her senior, men she knew to be close friends,
both veterans of legal and political wars. Blackburn was behind his massive desk, and Clancy was sitting to her left. They looked like clones in their navy blue suits, white shirts, and red, white, and blue striped ties. When she'd first walked into the room, she'd been intimidated. She'd felt her hands begin to tremble slightly, and had briefly considered telling Blackburn she was feeling ill and would like to reschedule. But then she'd forced herself to look hard at Ben Clancy, and the slow burn had begun. She was a lawyer. Her job was to stand up to people like Clancy. She thought about Darren, and the innumerable humiliations he'd faced, the beatings he'd taken, the immeasurable losses he'd endured.
"I was hoping we could speak privately," Grace said to Blackburn.
"You said this was about Darren Street," Blackburn said. "Anything that concerns Darren Street concerns Ben. Do you know where he is?"
"No," Grace said. She turned her head toward Clancy. "But I know where James Tipton is."
Clancy's flinch was barely perceptible.
"Who?"
Blackburn said.
"James Tipton. Who is James Tipton?"
"He was Mr. Clancy's star witness against Darren Street."
"So you know where he is," Blackburn said. "Is that supposed to mean something? How is that important?"
"Mr. Clancy blackmailed him into killing Jalen Jordan, the man Darren was convicted of killing, and then lying at the trial. Every bit of Tipton's testimony was a lie, and every bit of it was coached by Mr. Clancy. But that wasn't enough. After the trial was over and Darren had been convicted, Mr. Clancy had him sent on a long diesel therapy session. You're familiar with diesel therapy, I assume?"
"My understanding is that diesel therapy is more of a legend than anything else," Blackburn said.
"Oh, no. It's very real," Grace said. "Isn't it, Mr. Clancy?"
"I have no idea," Clancy said.
"He didn't stop there," Grace said. "According to James Tipton, Mr. Clancy tried to kill him, I suppose to clean up loose ends. Then he burned Tipton's home to the ground."
Blackburn's eyebrows raised, but a burst of laughter came from Clancy.
"These are the most outrageous things I've ever heard," Clancy said. "I've been accused of a lot during my years as a prosecutor, Miss Alexander, but this takes the cake. I'm hearing conspiracy to commit murder, subornation of perjury, attempted murder, and arson. Please tell me you haven't come in here making these accusations without some kind of proof."
Grace refused to respond to him.
"Mr. Clancy also made a drug case against Mr. Tipton disappear," Grace said to Blackburn. "My understanding is that all of the digital records of the case have been deleted. But I have this."
Grace leaned forward and set the file Gary DuBose had given her in front of Blackburn. He picked it up, thumbed through it for a couple of minutes, and closed it. He looked at Clancy.
"Well," he said. "Where did you allegedly get whatever it is you just gave to Stephen?"
Clancy said to Grace, who again refused to respond directly to him.
"The file was provided to me by a DEA agent who is as appalled as I am, and as everyone else will be, by what Mr. Clancy did," Grace said to Blackburn. "When I asked Mr. Clancy's witness in court whether he had been offered anything by the government in exchange for his testimony, the witness said no. That in itself is enough to get Darren Street a new trial. Mr. Clancy, of course, knew he was committing perjury. As a matter of fact, Mr. Clancy was the one who went to the DEA supervisor and convinced him to make Mr. Tipton's drug case disappear from the computer."
"Who is the agent?" Clancy said.
"Be quiet, Ben," Blackburn said. "Do you have anything else, Miss Alexander?"
Grace reached into the pocket of the jacket she was wearing and produced a flash drive. She opened her briefcase and removed her laptop, turned it on, and inserted the device.
"I'm just going to show you a few examples," she said. "There are hours and hours of video and audio on this drive. I'll leave it with you. I have plenty of copies."
Grace began showing snippets, a sort of highlight film she'd put together the previous night, of the video and audio for Blackburn and Clancy. She would hear the occasional snort and chuckle from Clancy, but Blackburn watched intently and without comment. After about 20 minutes, Blackburn raised his hand and said,
"That's enough."
He looked at Clancy and said,
Ben, thank you for your time. Miss Alexander and I will take it from here.
But she's making unsubstantial allegations against me, Clancy said. She's assassinating my character. I'm entitled to defend myself.
She isn't the first person to come to me with concerns about the way you conducted yourself on this case, Blackburn said. Now for the last time, get up and leave the room.
Grace breathed a sigh of relief as Clancy closed the door behind him.
What do you want, Miss Alexander?
Blackburn said. Grace looked at him curiously.
What do I want? I'm not sure what you mean.
You've obviously come here to make some kind of deal, Blackburn said. I'm asking you what you want. What are your terms, your objectives?
I think it's pretty obvious, Grace said. He needs to go straight to prison.
Not going to happen, Blackburn said.
I beg your pardon?
Ben Clancy isn't going to prison. You can remove that from your list before we go another step.
But why? How can you... After what I've just shown you, how could you possibly...
What you just showed me were some papers that could easily and simply have been made up. They don't prove a thing. And I can promise you, you won't get any corroboration from anyone in the DEA.
But they made a case disappear. There will be a supervisor, other agents.
No, Miss Alexander, there won't. Do you know what happens to whistleblowers in the federal system? Especially in law enforcement? They are turned into outcasts. They are sent to Boise and assigned to minutiae, or they're investigated closely and charged with crimes themselves. They don't become heroes. The agent who decided to provide you with this file made a mistake in judgment. I don't know who he is, but I could find out very easily. I'm willing to forgive his indiscretion, however, provided you're willing to be reasonable.
I'll go straight to the press, Grace said.
Ah, yes, take it to the tattletales, the whiny voyeurs. All you'd accomplish would be to embarrass yourself. This paper file? Forged. Made up by a troubled agent looking for some kind of validation. Not a scrap of corroboration. At best, you might get some congressional committee to appoint a former FBI assistant director or a retired U.S. attorney to conduct an independent investigation, which will ultimately, 2 or 3 years down the road, conclude that there isn't enough proof to take any meaningful action. In the meantime, your client, Mr. Street, will most likely be caught or killed. And your video? You have nothing that was taped prior to Jalen Jordan's murder. You have images and recordings of very poor quality that may or may not be Ben Clancy talking about a case he is prosecuting. Even if I was willing to agree that it's Ben on those recordings, and I'm not, prosecutors talk to their witnesses all the time, just like defense lawyers talk to their witnesses all the time.
Grace began to pack up her things. The smugness, the arrogance that was being displayed was making her angrier by the second.
You still haven't answered my question, Miss Alexander, Blackburn said.
What question?
Grace said through clenched teeth.
What do you want? Within reason, and without Mr. Clancy going to prison. I'm the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Tennessee. I was appointed to this office by the President of the United States. I simply will not allow you to bring disgrace upon me and everyone else in this office. I will not allow you to make us all look like fools by agreeing to sacrifice one of my assistants, especially one who has been a friend for most of my life.
I can't believe you'd allow him to continue to...
He won't be continuing. Today will be his last day on the job, if you and I can come to some kind of agreement. He will retire. Ben Clancy has been, for the most part, an effective and passionate prosecutor, although I admit he has, on occasion, become overzealous.
Overzealous? He orchestrated a murder and pinned it on Darren Street. That's a bit beyond overzealous, don't you think?
Again, what do you want?
I want the jury's verdict vacated in Darren Street's case immediately, and I want him declared not guilty. I'm sure an escape charge has been filed against him in the district court in California, and I want that dropped. I want Darren to be able to get his life back, the life Ben Clancy took from him. I want a guarantee in writing that James Tipton will not face any criminal charges for killing Jalen Jordan, or for anything else. He gets blanket immunity.
I can't put it in writing. But I'll give you my word, Blackburn said. Tipton won't be bothered.
And Darren Street?
Done,
Blackburn said. Grace felt her jaw drop. Done? Just like that?
Just like that.
How can you do it? Grace said. I mean, without the press knowing. How can you sell it to a judge?
Like Ben Clancy, Judge Gear happens to be an old and dear friend. I'll stop by his house this evening. When we go into open court after the judgment is entered and Mr. Street is officially declared not guilty, I'll request the files be sealed due to the sensitive nature of the ongoing investigation. Nobody will really care that Jalen Jordan's killer might still be walking around, so I don't expect there to be a huge uproar, and even if there is, I'll refuse to talk to anyone in the press. It will blow over quickly.
And you'll call off the dogs at the marshals and the FBI so Darren doesn't get killed before we get it done?
Blackburn nodded.
So do we have a deal, Miss Alexander?
Blackburn said. Your client goes free, and James Tipton gets a free pass on a murder that he may or may not have committed.
And Clancy never sets foot in a courtroom again,
Grace said. And Ben retires, effective immediately.
He'll still have a law license. Nothing I can do to keep him from practicing if he wants to. I'm assuming you can produce Mr. Street?
I know how to get in touch with him.
Have him in Judge Gear's courtroom at 8:30 in the morning, and if anyone from the press shows up, I'll know it was you who called them.
I won't talk to them, Grace said, and I'm sure Darren will feel the same way.
If he doesn't, it will definitely be a problem, and now that I think about it, I'm going to protect myself just a bit. I'll ask the court to vacate the jury verdict and dismiss the murder charge with prejudice, but I'm going to keep my options open on the escape. I'll get the U.S. attorney in California to ask the court there to dismiss the case, but not with prejudice. That way, if your client decides to start popping off to the press, he'll suddenly find himself doing 10 years.
I'm not going to let you hold him hostage, Grace said.
Take it or leave it. You already know how I feel about taking a case against Ben to the grand jury. If you want to rely on the press to be your knight in shining armor, be my guest.
Grace looked at Blackburn closely, trying to read his face. She hadn't heard anything about Blackburn in her 3 years in the Federal Defender's Office that would cause her to distrust him. But the compromise he was proposing was almost untenable.
Clancy walk away scot-free? From a murder? And besides, could she trust him?
On the other hand, she'd accomplished her primary goal, which was to set Darren free and get the escape charge dismissed.
He could walk out of court tomorrow a free man. To hell with Clancy, she thought. I'll take it.
She set her briefcase on the floor, stood, took a step toward Blackburn's desk, and as much as she hated the thought of touching him, stuck out her hand. Blackburn also stood, their hands clasped.
I don't know how you live with yourself,
Grace said.
I sleep quite well, Miss Alexander, Blackburn said. I'll see you in the morning.
Chapter 58.
As soon as Ben Clancy saw Grace Alexander walk past his office, he was on his feet. He strode past Stephen Blackburn's secretary and burst into Blackburn's office without knocking.
I've never been so humiliated in my life, Clancy said
as he stood in front of Blackburn's desk. His heart was pounding, and he could feel heat in his cheeks.
It could have been worse, Blackburn said calmly. Sit down, Ben, and keep your mouth shut.
How dare you speak to me in such a... I said, sit down and shut your mouth.
Clancy was stunned by the tone. In all of the years he'd known Blackburn, he'd never heard him speak so harshly. Clancy slid slowly into the chair, wondering what was to come next.
Dan Reed came to me the day after Jalen Jordan was shot, and after you'd accused him and his people of being involved, and told me he thought you were responsible. He couldn't prove it, of course, but he made a far more compelling argument than you did at the time. I let it go because I thought both of you were simply overreacting to the stress of the situation, and because I couldn't allow myself to believe that I'd misjudged your character so badly.
You haven't misjudged my... I told you to be quiet, and I meant it. You're this close to being arrested for murder.
Clancy folded his arms and began rocking back and forth in the seat. He rolled his eyes, scoffing at the idea he might be arrested. After having seen and heard what I did a little while ago, I've come to the conclusion that you were directly responsible for the death of Jalen Jordan, and that you knowingly and intentionally framed Darren Street. You conspired with James Tipton to commit murder. You instructed him to plant and manipulate evidence. You obstructed justice. You committed perjury, and you suborned perjury. You initiated and perpetrated a blatant fraud on the United States District Court, and you did it purely out of spite, because you hate Darren Street. And why do you hate Darren Street? Because he exposed you for doing the same kind of thing to his uncle. I've been a fool, Ben. You've played all of us for fools, but that stops today. I made a deal with Miss Alexander. Darren Street gets out, and so do you. You're out of here, Ben, as of this minute. I was thinking about allowing you to retire, but I've decided I'm not going to ask the taxpayers of the United States to keep you up after what you've done. Clancy started to say something as Blackburn picked up his phone and punched in a few numbers, but Blackburn held up his hand. Marshal Cole, Blackburn said, would you please send three of your people to Ben Clancy's office immediately to escort him out of the building? He's been fired. Clancy leaned forward and extended his hands, palms up, as Blackburn set the phone down.
Stephen, please, Clancy said. We're old friends.
Not anymore.
But this will ruin me. My reputation. How will I make a living?
I don't care. Now get out before I change my mind and have you arrested. Clancy stood. He could feel his cheeks warming, and his hands had involuntarily clenched into fists.
You haven't heard the last of me, Clancy said. I'll sue. I'll drag you into court.
Be my guest, Blackburn said, just as the marshals walked through the door. Chapter 59. Ben Clancy looked over as his wife, Rose, finished her morning coffee, rinsed the cup in the kitchen sink, and loaded it into the dishwasher. He'd grown to hate the woman over the years, but right now he had other people to hate, primarily Stephen Blackburn.
Ben,
Rose said,
this is really bothering me. Why won't you tell me what happened at the office?
Nothing happened, Ben snapped.
I tried to call Stephen Blackburn yesterday after you got home, and he wouldn't speak to me. Maybe he was out of the office, but I didn't...
Ben was in her face immediately.
Don't ever call there again, he yelled. How dare you? I've never struck you, Rose, but I swear, if you continue to push me and nag me, I don't know what I might do.
Go ahead and hit me,
Rose said.
You'll very quickly find yourself in one of those jails you loved to fill with other people.
Clancy spun around and walked toward the garage. He was soon in his car, which he drove down the road a short ways. He turned left onto a dead end called Charlie's Cove, parked the car, got out, locked the door, and stuck the keys in his pocket. Charlie's Cove was about a half mile from his home on the Tennessee River. The morning was brisk and windy because a cold front had rolled in. The sun was not quite over the ridge to the east, and Clancy had dressed quickly and warmly in a jacket and a stocking cap. He carried a stick of hickory in his right hand and began walking. The shock of what had happened the previous day was still fresh in his mind. The nerve of James Tipton. Shoes? Clancy had never remotely considered that Tipton might have the brains or ingenuity to pull off something so clever. But the videos had been of poor quality, and the audio really didn't prove much. And Tipton was the real killer, so why was he, Clancy, being persecuted? His tenure in the U.S. Attorney's Office might be over, but Clancy wasn't finished. Not by a long shot. He would take a brief vacation and leave his carping wife at home. The South Carolina coast was always beautiful. He'd go there and think, consider his options. Congress, he thought suddenly. I'll run for a seat in the United States Congress, and I'll win. The guy in office now is an idiot. Charlie's Cove dead-ended at a circular cul-de-sac, and it was just as he'd gone around the circle and was heading back in the opposite direction that Clancy first noticed the SUV coming slowly toward him. He encountered traffic on Charlie's Cove occasionally, but he could go days without seeing a vehicle. The vehicle rolled slowly by. It was black, with windows tinted so darkly that Clancy couldn't see inside. Clancy kept walking. The rush of the wind drowned out the sound of the van's engine, and within seconds, Clancy's mind was moving on to the organization he would have to build in order to make an effective run for Congress. Many of the pieces were already in place from the last campaign he ran, when he was defeated by Mike Smith in the Knox County District Attorney General's race. There were a few people he wouldn't ask to return, people he thought were ineffective, and who had reacted slowly and stupidly to Darren Street's smear campaign. The thought of Street made his blood pressure rise even more. Street, whom he'd convicted of murder, had escaped from a federal penitentiary, and now he would be walking the streets a free man. Clancy shook his head. He should have found ways to kill both Street and Tipton. But he'd be back. He had to make it back. Living well was the best revenge, and Clancy intended to live well. He'd served the taxpayers of the district his entire adult life. He saw no reason to stop now. Being elected to the U.S. Congress would pay him nearly $200,000 a year, more than he made as a district attorney general, and more than he made as an assistant U.S. attorney. He snickered at the thought of being run out of governmental service, only to return triumphantly with more power and at a higher salary. Clancy saw a flash to his left and realized the van had pulled up next to him and stopped. The doors popped open, and men with guns quickly surrounded him. Dan Reed, the special agent in charge of the Knoxville office, walked around the front of the car. He was smiling.
"You're under arrest, you miserable son of a bitch," Reed said as Clancy felt cold steel wrap around his wrists.
Chapter 60. I'd barely slept in 2 nights. The first night, I was up with James and Grace all night while he was showing her his video and audio evidence. It was the second time I'd seen and heard Clancy scheming to frame me for murder, and it made my blood boil. The next night, after Grace had her meeting with Stephen Blackburn, I was so full of conflict, I could barely close my eyes. On the one hand, the realization that my nightmare might be over was creeping into my consciousness, causing me to feel a cautious excitement. Would I really be allowed to start over? Would I practice law again? Would I sleep in a regular bed and eat real food again? Would I hold my son in my arms? Or would I be locked up again as soon as I showed my face in court? Granny had allowed me to stay in a small spare bedroom at her house that was usually reserved for when one or more of her grandchildren wanted to sleep over. She'd fed me a breakfast of eggs, bacon, sausage, hash browns, and biscuits and gravy with coffee. It was the best food I'd tasted in years, but I'd eaten very little. At 7 a.m., I dialed my mother's number on the second of my 3 burn phones.
"Hello?"
she said.
"It's me."
I heard her inhale and exhale deeply.
I thought you might be...
"I'm fine, Mom. I'm not all that far away from you. Can you be at the federal courthouse at 8:30?
Why, Darren?
"I'm going to turn myself in."
"Turn yourself in? Why did you escape in the first place? What the hell was going through your mind? Did you really think you could get away with it? Did you think you'd ride off into the sunset? Did you think you'd somehow miraculously prove yourself innocent and they'd let you go? Or were you hoping they'd kill you?"
"Calm down, Mom."
"Calm down? They're going to squash you again, Darren. And if you think I'm going to come to the courthouse and watch them do it, you've got another thing coming."
"They're going to let me go." There was a long silence. I could envision her standing or sitting in her kitchen with her forehead resting on her long fingers.
"What did you say?"
"They're going to let me go, Mom. At least, that's what I think. Grace did it. I'll explain it to you afterward, because what you're going to see and hear in the courtroom won't be the whole truth. Will you come? Please? I'm going to need a place to stay for a while." She broke down. I could hear her crying at the other end of the phone and desperately wanted to wrap my arms around her. "I'm sorry for everything I put you through, Mom," I said. She continued to cry, apparently unable to speak. Eventually, she was able to squeak something that sounded like,
"I'll be there."
And the phone went dead.
Eugene gave me a ride down the mountain and dropped me off in downtown Knoxville, about 5 blocks from the courthouse. I was still wearing the bruises from the beating he'd given me, but I felt absolutely no animosity toward him.
"Thank you," I said as I climbed out of the Jeep.
"Good luck to you, counselor,"
Eugene said, and he pulled away from the curb and drove off. Grace and I met a block away and walked in the front door at 8 a.m. The two marshals who manned the metal detectors recognized me immediately. Both of them walked toward me as one produced a set of handcuffs. Both were pressing the buttons on their ear sets and talking quietly. I felt an urge to turn and run.
"Wait," Grace said as she stepped between them and me. "This is prearranged. The charges against him are going to be dismissed."
"But as of this moment, they're still pending and he's a fugitive," the taller of the two marshals said. "He's going to holding."
"Stop it,"
Grace said. They were pulling my hands behind my back. She reached out and tried to pull one of them away. He held her off while they finished locking the cuffs.
"We didn't shoot him," the marshal said, "and we could have. We're just following orders. He walks in the door, he gets cuffed. He goes to lock up until the judge is ready for him. After that, we'll see."
They were pulling me away from the door by the elbows as two other marshals showed up and took their places on the door.
"It'll be fine, Darren,"
Grace was saying behind me.
"Everything will be okay."
"You're one lucky son of a bitch,"
the marshal to my left said into my ear as we walked down the hall to an elevator.
"Yeah?
How's that?
Break out of Rosewood in a helicopter and you're still alive a week later? Up until this morning, we've all had orders to shoot you on sight."
"Your idea of luck and mine are entirely different," I said. "Maybe someday you'll be fortunate enough to share in some of the luck I've experienced during the past 2 years."
We entered an elevator, and the guy on my left pushed a button.
"Are you busting my balls, inmate?"
he said.
I decided to take a calculated risk. I didn't think they'd want to take me into the courtroom with any fresh bruises.
"Go fuck yourself, robot," I said.
The kidney punch drove me to my knees, and I decided to shut my mouth. His final gesture was to kick me in the ass so hard as I walked into the holding cell that I couldn't feel my left leg for 20 minutes. They left the cuffs on me. When it came time for me to go into the courtroom, two different marshals accompanied me. Neither of them said a word during the walk. I didn't either. When I walked into the courtroom, Grace was sitting at the defense table. She got up immediately and stepped to the lectern where the marshals led me. A man I recognized as U.S. Attorney Stephen Blackburn was standing next to the prosecution table. There was a clerk sitting next to the judge's bench, my mother sitting in the gallery, and that was it. There was no one else. No lawyers milling around. No reporters. The two marshals who brought me in were standing against the wall, seemingly camouflaged by the woodwork. Grace put her hand on my forearm and patted it.
"Almost there," she said.
One of the marshals came off the wall long enough to announce that court was in session as Judge Donnie Gere walked in. Gere took his seat and peered down over his nose at me like I was an insect, an unsavory pest.
"Well, Mr. Street, you're back," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"Unusual circumstances this time."
"Pretty unusual circumstances last time, too," I said, and I felt Grace kick me in the ankle. She obviously wanted me to shut up.
"I understand the government has a motion in this case,"
the judge said.
"Yes, Your Honor," Blackburn said from my left.
"New evidence has come to light in Mr. Street's case. Evidence that leads me to believe beyond any doubt that Mr. Street did not commit the crime for which he was convicted. I cannot unfortunately comment on the exact nature of the evidence at this time, because to do so would impede, or, at the worst, entirely compromise an ongoing investigation. However, given the evidence, I also cannot in good conscience allow Mr. Street to remain in prison. Therefore, the government moves the court to vacate the jury's verdict against Mr. Street and enter a judgment of not guilty."
"I understand an escape charge was filed against him in the district court in California,"
the judge said.
Is he to be remanded to custody to deal with that charge?
No, sir. I have here a copy of an order signed by a judge in the Eastern District of California yesterday afternoon. The case is dismissed.
Blackburn passed a copy of the order to the clerk, who handed it to the judge.
Very well, then, Judge Gere said. Miss Alexander, do you have anything to say?
I thought the file was going to be sealed,
Grace said.
There really isn't any need, Blackburn said. We arrested Ben Clancy this morning.
Grace's head jerked toward Blackburn, who looked at her and said, I changed my mind. We'll let a jury sort it out.
Thank you,
Grace said. I could tell she was as stunned as I was. The first thing that went through my mind was Clancy having to squat and cough during a strip search. The bastard. He'd finally get a little of what he deserved.
Mr. Street, the judge said, anything you'd like to say?
No, sir.
All right. Then upon motion of the government, and there being no opposition from the defense, the court hereby vacates the jury's verdict in the United States of America versus Darren Street.
Would you please ask the marshal to remove his handcuffs?
Grace said.
The judge nodded toward the marshals, and one of them walked over and removed the cuffs. I rubbed my wrists and looked up at Gere, and a feeling of relief enveloped me like a lagoon of warm seawater. My vision suddenly became clearer, and Grace's perfume filled my nostrils. I felt light, like rice paper. If a gentle breeze had blown at that moment, it would have lifted me up and floated me out of the courtroom.
I presided over your trial, as you know, Mr. Street, the judge said. I heard all of the evidence, and from what I heard, the jury was justified in returning the verdict it did. So I don't think this court owes you an apology. I admit that signing Mr. Clancy's arrest warrant troubled me greatly, but seeing you released like this reaffirms my faith in what I believe to be the most effective system of criminal justice in the world. In the meantime, I wish you the best in your return to society. Do you plan to return to practicing law?
I'm not really sure, I said. Maybe. Probably.
Perhaps I'll see you again sometime then. Mr. Street, you're free to go. Court is adjourned.
Suddenly, Grace, Mom, and I were the only people in the courtroom. We wrapped our arms around each other and stood near the bar. Tears were streaming freely, and I was unashamed. None of us could say a word.
Chapter 61. I walked out of the courtroom that day a free man, but my life as I knew it had still been obliterated. It was as though I'd woken up from a coma that had lasted for more than 2 years. I had to start over from scratch. I had a little money stashed in the corporation my mother had helped me form when I was in prison, but I'd paid a substantial amount to Big Pappy Donovan, and what I had left was barely enough to get by on. I had no job, no car, no house or apartment, so I immediately moved in with my mom, who was genuinely glad to have me, but who had grown accustomed to living on her own. We worked it out, but not without some tense moments. As soon as Katie read in the paper that I'd been released from prison, she had her lawyer file a petition in court to revoke my mother's visitation privileges with Sean. I filed my own petition asking for visitation rights. I represented myself, and it took months, but I was finally able to get in front of a judge, and Katie was forced to let me see my son. The visits for the first month were supervised by a worker from the Tennessee Department of Children's Services, but she very quickly figured out how much I loved Sean and how much he loved me, and the supervision ended. I get him every other weekend right now. Katie demanded child support, of course, which I was more than happy to pay. I'm paying 21% of the approximately $500 a week I'm making as a freelance paralegal for several different lawyers in Knoxville. She gets $420 a month. I'm hoping to get joint custody of Sean as soon as I can afford my own place. I'm sure Katie knows it's coming, and I'm sure she'll fight me tooth and nail. She still lives in the nice home we bought when we were married, and from what I understand, her parents are helping her out a great deal.
She's also still seeing her sugar daddy from Lexington. I hope he has a heart attack in the sack. Initially, I sent an email to the Tennessee Board of Professional Responsibility and asked them to reinstate me as an attorney, since the jury's verdict had been vacated in my case. I was very quickly informed by those miserable bureaucratic bastards that I had been disbarred because I was a danger to the community, and the only way to have my license reinstated was to go through a long, drawn-out hearing process, during which a heavy burden of proof would be placed upon me to prove I was no longer dangerous. I told them to schedule the hearing. They said it would be 6 months, which is 2 months from now. Grace and I are taking it slow, which, I believe, is a sign that I'm not as impetuous as I may have been in the past. She's a remarkable woman, and I remain convinced that I'm in love with her, but we went through such a turbulent time together that I want to be sure we can stick together without a war to fight, without a cause to champion. If it works out, and I have no reason to think it won't, then I could see us having a future together, maybe even working together. I'd like nothing better than to build a firm that would usurp Richie Fells's firm as the top group of criminal defense lawyers in the state of Tennessee. 2 weeks ago, Grace, my mom, and I made a trip up the mountain to spend an afternoon with the Tipton clan to celebrate Granny's 75th birthday. It wasn't my weekend with Sean, and even if it had been, I wouldn't have taken him. The Tiptons were, after all, alleged drug dealers, but those folks knew how to throw a party. They'd smoked chicken and ribs and had slow-roasted a small pig and pulled the meat from it. There was also a large picnic table covered entirely in side dishes and desserts. The barbecue sauce they'd made for the meat was the best I'd ever tasted. All three grandsons were there, along with wives and children and several close friends who I suspected were employees of the family drug business. A bluegrass band consisting of a guitarist, an upright bass player, a fiddler, and a banjo picker was set up on Granny's front porch. About 15 minutes into their first set, they broke into a song called "Rollin' in My Sweet Baby's Arms," and I felt a tug on my arm. "Let's dance," Grace said. I'd never danced to mountain music, but I'd had a couple of beers and was feeling pretty good, so I said, "Okay." I took her right hand in my left and wrapped my other hand around her waist, and we started gliding across the grass. "You're a natural," Grace said. She was smiling widely, which I loved. "My partner ain't bad either," I said. We danced around the yard for a few minutes with the sun on our faces and Grace's beautiful hair flying like a golden web. When the music stopped, she leaned in and kissed me on the cheek. "Thank you," she said. She did those sorts of things all the time. Simple things. A smile here, a wink and a nod there, a kiss on the cheek. And every time she did something like that, it gave me goosebumps. We spent the afternoon eating, drinking, dancing, and playing. Along about 7:30, as the sun was starting to drop behind the mountain ridges to the west, Granny, who had a white shawl wrapped around her shoulders, came up and placed her hand on my elbow. "Do you have a minute for an old lady?" she said. "I have all the time you need," I said. "Walk with me." She wrapped her right arm in my left, and we wandered away from the others. Before I knew it, we were standing in back of the barn. Four hogs were on the other side of a stout wooden fence. When they saw Granny, they came over and began snorting and rooting.
"I wanted to tell you we're out of the business we used to be in," she said. "It was just too much trouble. Too dangerous."
"That's good to hear, Granny. What are you guys going to do?" She chuckled, and her eyes flickered.
"We're going to make moonshine, but we're going to do it legal. Eugene has already gotten things pretty much set up. We're having a still shipped in from Canada, of all places. It should be here in a couple of weeks."
"Good luck with it," I said. "I hope it works out well."
"Can I ask your honest opinion about something?"
Granny said. "Absolutely."
"Do you think they'll be able to convict Ben Clancy?"
I'd given that a lot of thought, and I didn't like the government's prospects. "It'll be tough," I said. "James has already testified in my trial, and you can believe Richie Fells will have the transcript. He's going to hammer James. It'll be, 'Are you lying now, or were you lying then?' James will have to admit he committed perjury during my trial, and Fells will use the admission to plant doubt in the jury's mind. Plus, James will have to admit that he pulled the trigger, and that he isn't going to serve any time. I don't see the jury convicting him. She was nodding slowly as I talked.
That's what I thought, she said. But the man tried to ruin James's life. I don't think he'll ever quite get over it. Forced him to kill a man. Forced him to lie about it and help send you to prison. Burned his home and tried to kill him. That's an evil man.
I agree with you about that. He's evil.
Do you believe in karma?
I pondered the question for a few seconds. I'm not sure if I'd call it that exactly, but I think there might be some kind of moral force in the universe that eventually balances things out. It takes a while sometimes, but eventually, people seem to get what they deserve.
I believe a person ought to get what he or she deserves, Granny said. Sometimes it happens naturally, and sometimes, well, sometimes somebody has to help things along.
She moved closer to the fence and nodded toward the pigs.
How much do you know about hogs? She said.
Not much. I'm a city boy.
I'll tell you why I ask. You remember that night you came here after you got out of prison?
I don't know how I could ever forget it.
You said something that night that made me curious. You asked us to leave you a gun. You said you'd climb in with the hogs and shoot yourself. You said they'd clean up the mess. What made you think a hog would eat a human?
I'm not really sure. I guess I've probably read it somewhere sometime. Maybe it's just some kind of urban legend. She nodded and was quiet for a minute.
I've been around hogs all my life, she said. I've helped butcher hundreds of them. Maybe 1,000 or more. They'll eat most anything, including a human. And if the jury doesn't convict him and they let him go, I might just see to it that Clancy winds up in this pig pen.
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that, I said, and she gave me a coy smile. I had no doubt she was capable of killing Clancy, or having him killed. If Clancy wound up being acquitted and suddenly disappeared, I put the thought out of my mind. We turned and walked back toward the party as the sun continued to drop behind the ridge to the west. The mountains were shimmering in the soft light, and I suddenly felt a sense of deep contentment. I'd made it through false accusation, humiliation, indignity, government-sponsored isolation and torture, beatings and stab wounds. It had taken years, but the wheels of justice, which had nearly ground me to dust, had somehow been reversed and were trying, at least, to make things right. Clancy probably wouldn't be convicted, but he might. And in the meantime, he'd been denied bond and was sitting in the same county jail on the same max block where I'd awaited trial. The fact that Clancy was in jail and I was out gave me a satisfying sense of redemption, but the contentment came from something much deeper. As I walked along with Granny and I spotted Grace and my mother standing together among the small crowd of people, it dawned on me how fortunate I was to have them and Sean, and how much I wanted to serve them, to protect them, to help make their lives meaningful and enjoyable. When we got close to the group, I broke away from Granny and walked straight up to Grace. I wrapped my arms around her waist, lifted her off the ground, and began to turn slowly in a circle. Have I thanked you for everything you did for me, Grace? I said. I'm here today because of you. She lifted her hands to my face and kissed me softly on the lips.
You're here today because you're a survivor, she said, and I'm glad to be along for the rest of the ride.
The rest of the ride. I had no idea what it would entail, but if it was to be anything like the ride I'd been on for the past couple of years, one thing was certain. At least it wouldn't be boring. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Justice Redeemed by Scott Pratt, performed by Nick Podell, engineered by Corey Barton.
Performance copyright 2015 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.